The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
To welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we are joined with a panel of three individuals to share their unique insights as we look at the historical legacy of religion in social protest and the value of spiritual values in constructive protest to advance the transformation of politics and society. On the panel today will be Rabbi Michael Lerner. He is clearly one of the nation's greatest Jewish intellectuals and spiritual political activist. As a teenager, Rabbi Lerner was a student of Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great socially responsible mystical thinker who marched with Martin Luther King. During the 1960s, he was chair of the Berkeley chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society and briefly incarcerated among the Seattle Seven while teaching the University of Washington. He was also one of the individuals who J. Edgar Hoover claimed was one of the most dangerous criminals in America. Rabbi Lerner is currently the editor of Tikkun magazine, an award-winning journal of interfaith and progressive critiques of American culture and politics and religion. He is also the founder of the Network for Spiritual Progressives. His most recent book is Embracing Israel and Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. And so he is one. The second panelist is Professor Daniel McCannon. Professor McCannon is the Ralph Waldo Emerson Unitarian Universalist Association Senior Lecturer at Harvard Divinity School, where he specializes in the American history of religious and spiritual movements for social transformation. Before coming to Harvard, he served as department chair and associate professor of theology at the University of St. Benedict and St. John's University, where he began teaching in 1998. He's written on theological understandings of violence, nonviolence among pacifists and radical activists, and Catholic social activism. His most recent book is Prophetic Encounters, Religion and the American Radical Tradition, from Oxford University Press. And finally, we have Professor Robert Thurman, who holds the J. Zong Kapot Robert Thurman Chair of Indo-Tibetan Studies at Columbia University. He is the president of the Tibet House USA, which is dedicated to preserving Tibetan civilization, and is president of the American Institute of Buddhist Studies. The New York Times has held Professor Thurman as the leading American expert on Tibetan Buddhism. In 1962, Professor Thurman was ordained as a Buddhist monk by the Dalai Lama, with whom he has remained a close colleague to this day. He is a passionate advocate not only for the rights of Tibetans, but globally. He has been sought by policymakers on the Tibetan Holocaust and has testified before Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's written many books on Tibetan culture and art and politics and Buddhism. His most recent is Why the Dalai Lama Matters: His Act of Truth as a Solution to China, Tibet, and the World. His earlier work, Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness, lays down the spiritual argument for nonviolent action based upon the Buddhist belief that individual happiness is interrelated with the happiness of all. That is our panel. I'd like to welcome all of you to this commentary hour.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be with you and Michael and Daniel.
I'm going to ask each of you, if you would please, before we have individual questions, to each take a shot at this one, and we'll start with Rabbi Lerner. Now, we have three major religious traditions with rich historical legacies represented here: Buddhism, Christianity, and Judaism. I feel each of you would agree that we seem to have embarked on a cultural path in this country that is leading in a negative direction. There are many voices today who would argue that America has turned into a culture of self-obsession, narcissism, destruction, including destroying our environment, our bodies, the water, our disregard for how toxic something is. We are awash in toxins, yet very little is being done to deal with this. And a sense of national self-righteousness that feels immune to the suffering our foreign policies and wars inflict upon other peoples and cultures. So I would like to hear from each of you now to offer your insights to critique our culture today with reference to the underlying spiritual causes behind what many believe are self-destructive behaviors. Rabbi Lerner.
Well, the globalization of capital, which I call the globalization of selfishness and materialism, is the globalization of a set of values that have been induced into and knocked into the heads of almost every American, in fact, almost everyone on the planet. And the spiritual world has an alternative. That is to say, the spiritual world was never meant to be, or never intended to be, cheerleaders for materialism and selfishness. It was it emerged as all of the major religions emerged with values of love, of caring, of generosity, of kindness, of nonviolence, of caring for others, paying attention to a larger framework of meaning and purpose for life that transcended the individualism and selfishness of the competitive marketplace. So, but what has happened in the past, over the course of the past several centuries, is that the belief in those values has decreased dramatically, in part because almost all religious traditions have lost their faith in their own values. And as a result, many of the religious traditions have unintentionally or unconsciously, but nevertheless very strongly, reverted to values that really were fundamentally opposed to those of its founders and those of its most visionary writers and thinkers. So that today, in almost every religious tradition, you will find a split between what I call the right hand of God and the left hand of God, between those who think that money and power is the key because they fear, they believe that domination and control over others is the only way to provide safety for themselves. But on the other hand, in every religious tradition, there is also a voice of what I call the left hand of God, that is, those who believe that love and kindness and generosity are really the best path to not only homeland security and safety in the world, but also the best path to a meaningful life for each individual. These two views are in contention within every religious tradition, but it's not religion's fault because the same struggle is going on amongst atheists and agnostics and everywhere in the world. And in fact, religion has a jump up on the scientific culture and the rest of the society, because whereas the scientific culture claims to be value neutral, the religious culture has at least one strong strand within it that really has a counter to the globalization of selfishness and materialism, that is, the values of the capitalist marketplace. So I see in the organization that we at Tikkun magazine, T-I-K-K-U-N, you can find it on the web at www.tikkun.org, that we advocate is a new bottom line for our society. We need a new bottom line in which institutions and social practices no longer get judged efficient, rational, or productive only to the extent that how much money they make or how much power they generate, but rather at least as much in terms of how much love and kindness, ethical and ecological sensitivity, ability and amongst people to recognize the spirit of God or the sanctity of other human beings, and the ability of people to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of all that is. In other words, a non-utilitarian attitude towards other human beings and towards the planet, or in a simple way of putting it, is that we want our society based on a goal of the caring society, caring for each other and caring for the earth. And you have that in the left hand of God vision or the left of the progressive vision in every religious tradition. And so there is some foundation for a counter to the ethos of materialism and selfishness of the capitalist marketplace, whereas outside the religious traditions, most of the other institutions claim to be value neutral, so they don't teach anything that gives people even a foundation for challenging the ruthless destruction of the planet and the ruthless transformation of human beings into utilities that can be judged only in terms of how much they can produce or what they can do for others, rather than seeing human beings as fundamentally valuable. The only place you get that, or the major place you can get that, is the foundation in the religious traditions.
Thank you for that. Sure. Professor McCannon, your shot at this, please.
Yes, thank you so much, Gary. I'm really delighted to be in this conversation and very honored to be in conversation with Rabbi Lerner and with Professor Thurman. I would certainly agree with everything that Michael Lerner just said. Religious traditions do have two sides to them, and in facing the challenges facing our country right now, there are ways in which religious traditions are very much the heart of the problem, are promoting destructive materialism, are promoting barriers between groups of people, and there are also ways in which religious traditions are at the heart of the solution, providing the ideals that will help us to embrace the interconnected web of all life and embrace the full human community. I think I would push back a little bit on the way you characterized our current situation of the United States having taken a wrong turn. I think in some ways, from a spiritual perspective, it's always the worst of times and always the best of times. And just as the threat to the well-being of our planet has never been greater, so, too, the number of people who see care for the earth as an integral part of their spirituality has never been higher. Just as militarism and violence are as threatening to the human communities as they've ever been, so, too, are we at a moment in the United States where more and more people have affirmed the full inclusion of people of all races, the full inclusion of people of all sexualities in the human experiment. And so you always have to look at both sides, speak prophetically to what's going wrong, and speak in wonder and praise to all that is good in the world at any given moment. In terms of the spiritual sources of what Rabbi Lerner so helpfully called the right hand and the left hand of faith, I think that in many ways, even within the right hand of faith, there is a positive dimension. Our friends in the religious right are speaking out of a deep concern that the structures, the institutions that have sustained human community are under threat, and they want to defend those institutions, even the oppressive aspects of those. And it's not surprising that the religious right has been on so much on the rise, because the pace of change is greater than it has ever been before. So if one is inclined to fear for the stability of institutions, there's a lot to fear right now. And those of us on the left, I think, have a responsibility as we speak prophetically, as we challenge the status quo, to also attend to the well-being of our communities, make sure that people are treated with dignity within our social change organizations, so that those who are fearful that society might fall apart will look to the lives of people on the left and say, oh, society isn't going to fall apart if we make these changes. New forms of community are arising even in the midst of change. And I think that's why it's so exciting that the Occupy movement has given itself the time to build community. I think as they succeed in doing that, I think people on the other side of the political divide will look to the movement and see that perhaps there's less to fear in progressive change than they've imagined.
Thank you. Professor Thurman, your turn, please.
Oh, yes, Gary. Thank you very much for including me in this wonderful conversation. I love, I'm actually part of Rabbi Lerner's network of spiritual progressives. I'm probably the laziest member, and I hardly ever show up, but I really love all of its ideals and all of its events. And I'm very honored to hear from Professor McKinnon. And I do agree that we're at this time in history, I think, where everything could go totally wrong, and all life on Earth could be obliterated. Actually, we've been there really for the last 50 years, and yet that could cause this tremendous awakening that, in fact, I expect to see happening by the helpful, you know, with the help of the angels, perhaps some higher angels as well as the higher angels of our own nature. Now, Buddhism, which I'm speaking sort of from that perspective, is a religion, certainly, but it also has a scientific dimension, psychological and philosophical, that I think may help bridging this gap between the religious people and the secularists, quote-unquote, or atheist type of people, scientific people, because we do need the scientific people. You know, the sort of many people like the fundamentalists of all of the religious traditions are turning away from the information and the realism of science about the planetary condition, about the unviability of ongoing militarism, about the polluting and destructive nature of consumerism and so forth, and the interruption with the whole ecology of the planet, the distinction of species, all of that. All that scientific knowledge, I think, is resisted by fundamentalists in all of the traditions, which may be the ones that Rabbi Lerner would classify on the right hand, which I would agree with him. And so I think we need a spirituality that can embrace humanism as well as the formal religions. And I think Buddhism can help with that, in that it is a religion, and yet it has this very strong critical psychology. And what the way Professor Rabbi Lerner, I think, very beautifully describes things, where he talks about selfishness and materialism as sort of the global cultural convention in some sense. And I think Professor McKinnon is right that's the good side of fundamentalism, is at least they're turning away from that. Although I think they're going then in an unrealistic direction of seeking to turn the clock back, which I don't think you can do. And so instead, you know, we take from both sides the idea that there is a spirituality of that is scientific and that can give a method whereby selfishness can be unraveled through, you know, contemplation, through self-analysis, through all the different types of therapies, not in the foolish, I think, or ultimately doomed materialist way of modern psychology, where they think that finally they're going to find a neurotransmitter that's going to produce, you know, altruism and enlightenment, which they're clearly not going to do, which then will sell to you, of course, and you'll have to buy. But I think that will never work, but that the mind can be educated, actually. It's kind of like an educational thing, but the mind can be educated to really live up to, you know, Rabbi Hillel's statement about doing unto others, or Jesus' statement of lose your life for my sake and therefore find eternal life. These kind of wonderful, inspiring religious ideals, you know, the problem that modern people have with them is they think they're unattainable. They think they're nice ideals, but no one can execute them. And I think that Buddhism can help in the sense of providing, methodologies where people actually can be re-educated away from selfishness. And I think that the ancient religious traditions did do that. They had their academies, I think the monasteries in ancient time, the mystics of different traditions. They did have this idea that you could actually transform human character, that it was not hopelessly irredeemable except after death, but that you could actually do something in life. And Buddhism, of course, as well as Hinduism and Taoism, the Asian traditions have been more systematic in that effort, and I think that's where Buddhism can really be of help. And for example, in regard to the Occupy movement, which I'm very, very proud of, young people and all kinds of people, the Union of Labor and youth moral and ethical older people and hopefully religious people, that they're going to put their bodies out in the way of this machine of a sort of militarized police state that we've had since 9/11, with the militarization of our police, actually, and these terrible acts like right now in Congress is one where you can be detained by the military forever, even as an American citizen, with no trial and no habeas corpus. You know, that's just right in the Senate. It was just passed in the Senate and the House just now. And, for example, worse than the Patriot Act. And this kind of thing, you know, I really love it that they're out there dealing with that. But what is really critical is that they not try to think of violent revolution, a concept that I tried to elaborate based on the Buddhist teaching that I'm still trying to learn myself about what I call cool heroism, a nonviolent, and not only nonviolent in physical action, but nonviolent mentally, where we don't hate the people who we think are on the wrong side, and we maybe vocally can state are on the wrong side and argue that they are, but we feel sympathy for them, and we try to see their point of view, and we try to communicate to them and never consider them hopeless and always try to keep reaching out to them to the bitter end, which is the essence of the nonviolent strategy mentally. I think we need to do that, and so we need to see that we cannot have, you know, we had violent revolutions against the robber barons and capitalisms 100 years ago, and it didn't work, and those communist, state capitalism people were just as bad or even worse than the other ones. And so the hot revolution always produces more violent oppressors, I think, than the cool one. And it's the cool one that we need. And so that's where I think an education that can become more widespread, and I think somehow a revival of monasticism is something that I look to. The Buddhists look to the Catholics, actually, to help with that. I think that's very, very important. And so anyway, that's sort of my basic statement about it. And I'm very hopeful. The Dalai Lama, by the way, just in resonating with what Professor McKinnon said, the Dalai Lama has a wonderful thing where he has what he calls four points of hope. At the beginning of the 20th century, everybody just threw their garbage away and the industry just threw their stuff away because they thought nature would always clean it all up and also resources were always free, which they still are economically today. But now everybody knows the limitations of the earth and there's environmentalism has risen a totally new. At the beginning of the 20th century, militarism was taken for granted and that was power and that was the way to decide things was to have force. And now everybody's sick of militarism except for the few people in government who rely on it to keep their mediocrity intact and in control. And their spirituality was looked at as unrealistic and idealistic, and science was going to give the answers to everything, material science. And now the spiritual perspective is beginning to be respected, even though sometimes it gets to be a little bit atavistic. And then the fourth thing, I forgot, but it's
probably
there.
The role of
and
women.
And it's good. What?
Was it something to do with the role of women?
But anyway, that's right. At the beginning of the 20th century, everybody thought that big citizens, systems like capitalism or, you know, institutions, capitalism, communism, socialism, all these isms were going to solve everything. And now, actually, worldwide people are beginning to realize that individuals have to rise up, not selfishly, but altruistically, and mobilize their altruism to make themselves happy, actually, and to get in and to really take that seriously, and not accept that this system or that system or this big state or those other people are going to solve it. Realize that people have to take responsibility themselves. That's his fourth point. Yeah. Okay. So those I would quote from a man much more alert than I am, is the Dalai Lama. And therefore, he remains optimistic, although heaven knows his people are suffering so badly that young monks and nuns are actually offering their lives in the fire to call the world's attention to the oppression they're receiving from the communists, actually, the capitalist communists of China nowadays. You know. So anyway, that's my opening idea,
Gary.
I appreciate your
opening comments, Professor Thurman. Once again, I'm going to ask each of you to address this, if you would, please. And I know that in Buddhism, there is a very long history of social and political protests among Buddhist monks. For example, the anti-colonial protests in Burma in the 1940s helped lead to the Burmese independence and the collapse of the Thai dictatorship in the late 70s, largely supported by the monastic community and the Buddhist anti-war protests, I think we're all aware, from the Vietnam Wars. In Christianity, there's been a long legacy of spiritual protests against slavery and civil rights of all types. Of course, everyone remembers Martin Luther King, but equally important, in my opinion, were leaders such as the Catholic activist Dorothy Day, or Frederick Douglass, or suffragette Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or Abby Foster, or William Garrison, even Thomas Merton and Daniel Berrigan in more recent times. And in Judaism, there's plenty of examples in the Torah, and in particular in the rabbinic literature, to support protest. For example, the teaching that remaining silent after witnessing an injustice or crime is punishable by God. And of course, Abraham Joshua Heschel marched with Martin Luther King and validated his support for civil rights by saying that he prayed with his feet. So although we have historical examples of spiritual protests, I would like to hear from each of you a fundamental teaching representing higher spiritual values within your tradition that could serve as a commandment as to where we should be looking for more social active issues. In other words, putting our energy to nonviolent protest.
Mm-hmm.
Let us start with you, Professor Thurman.
Okay, well, briefly, let me just say that Buddhism has had a bad habit in history also of turning away from the world and saying it's hopeless, samsara, some versions of Buddhism, you know, and some individuals within Buddhism. Buddhism by no means has a perfect record. And a lot of people get into, for example, amongst the contemporary American Buddhists, there's a lot who say, I'm not getting off my meditation pillow, the world is hopeless, nothing you can do about it. And that is a bad habit that Buddhism has exhibited now and then in history fairly frequently. And also sometimes, like in the case of recently in Sri Lanka, where there was terrible intolerance shown toward the Tamil people, who are Hindu, by the Buddha. So Buddhism can have even though they don't have God in the same sense, they can have a right hand of something ignorant in the name of Buddhism, and they can misuse it the way that I think people in all religions do misuse them. So Buddhism by no means is perfect. On the other hand, I think that the Buddha himself set the example in that he was to be crowned a king, which in the Indian system means the head soldier, the West Point graduate, and conquer other kingdoms. You know, this, the military caste were the kings in ancient India. And he rejected that role, and he went out to discover a higher conquest, which is the conquest of the egocentric self, and by controlling yourself. And so Buddhism does have that from the beginning, and the creation of monasticism. He actually invented monasticism in 500 years or 700 years before it emerged in the West, and in China, 800 years before it emerged in China because of the Indian greater tolerance of such things. And so, and monasticism, it is a very strong form of activism, I've always said, because it gets people, young men particularly, out of military and pursuits and gets them into turning their violence back on itself and learning to become gentle and peaceful, and had a very powerful impact, I think, in Western history. And so Buddhism is activist, yes, but in a different way than what we think of as, like, you know, the Russian Revolution or, you know, even any violent revolution, because of the Buddhist view that violence always leads to violence, and so you don't need to, you know, it won't help actually to overthrow a violent bunch of people with more violence, because then the people who win, who overthrow them, get there by being more violent than their oppressors, and then they are terrible when they become oppressors. So Buddhism is into a more slow and more sure social change, and change through education, and change through individual self-development and self-transcendence, and in general. But in the modern period, I do agree with you, and I do think that the example set today of people who, like Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, marching with Martin Luther King, the Vietnamese monk, you know, and even sadly some of those monks who sacrifice themselves to sort of show people that there's something more than being attached to even their own bodies, in a generous and a glorious, trusting, faithful way. I think that's very, very powerful, although one would always advise someone not to do that, but when they do, you have to admire it. So the Buddhist kind of activism that I think we need today is an activism where we joyfully resist the negative, and we try not to even frighten the evildoers, so to speak, and that we don't hate them, we just want them to stop what they're doing, and we're going to put ourselves in the way of them. That kind of like what Occupy people are doing. Even actually, you know, the Dalai Lama was very, very moved in 1989 at Tiananmen Square, and he spoke subsequently to the Chinese students who protested the Chinese dictatorship in Tiananmen Square, that they stopped their own members who wanted to go up and throw red paint on Mao's portrait at, you know, in the Heavenly Gate, Gate of Heavenly Peace, whatever it's called, and who wanted to do some violent thing. And he insisted all the students maintain nonviolence. And he asked them, why did you do that when you grew up in a society where the Mao's theory was that, you know, the barrel of a gun is what decides everything. Truth comes out of the barrel of a gun. And they said, because they were inspired by the Gandhi movie. And they were inspired by Buddhist ideals that they somehow dug up out of their communist education. And he was really deeply impressed by that. And I think it's a global thing that these young people in Egypt, in the Arab world, and women especially, where they're rising here and there, and Occupy movement finally in America, the Ukrainians, the Velvet Revolution in Eastern Europe, these are all movements of people who realize that the old violent way is simply no longer viable. And therefore, there's a kind of cool heroism that people have to aspire to and train themselves to. And if they find when they're marching, they're really hating the people they're marching against, then maybe they should go and meditate on a pillow until they don't hate anymore. So that's kind of the new discipline, maybe, in the new movement that I think that Buddhism would certainly urge us to think about.
Thank you. Rabbi Lerner?
Well, the first thing I do want to say is I really want to commend what Bob Thurman has just said. I think it's brilliant comments, and there's much to learn from Buddhism that is useful for Judaism, Christianity, and for all the non-religions as well. You asked about a fairly narrowly constructed question, as I understood it, which was, is there that would I like to quote a source in our holy text that could be foundational, right? And
yes.
So, what in response to that? Yes, there is. I mean, there are many in from the moment that the Cain and Abel story ends with Cain saying, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the frame being one of God's response being, "You're yes, of course you are. You're responsible." But there's a law in the book of Deuteronomy that says the following: if somebody comes through your town and is subsequently found in the fields dead, then the elders of the towns near where this body is found should measure what's the nearest town and which is the town that he came through, and if it's and then the elders of the city where the near the town where he came through should do a repentance, and they have to do an atonement sacrifice. So the rabbis say, well, why in the world would this be the case? And the answer that the rabbis give is, because perchance he came to your town and needed help, and you didn't give it to him. And that his being found dead in the may have been a result of your negligence of the stranger, the person you didn't know, who passes through your town, and you don't take enough attention to him to know what he needs and take care of it. And for that, the elders of the community are charged with being guilty of the murder and must do repentance and an atonement sacrifice. So this is a consciousness that is sorely lacking in Western societies and any capitalist societies, the consciousness that we are all fundamentally interconnected, that our well-being depends on the well-being of everyone else on the planet, and that we have an absolute moral obligation to care. Now, this is not an obligation that is in the law system of Anglo-Saxon common law. Common law allows people to shrug their shoulders and say, hey, I have to take care of myself. That person has to take care of himself. I don't have any obligation to care for others. And one of the things that we in the network of spiritual progressives, have talked about, and you can find that on the web at spiritualprogressives.org, is that we need to change the fundamental assumption of American law and create an obligation to care for others. So that yes, we are not only morally but should be legally bound to pay attention to the suffering of other people and alleviate it.
Excellent. Thank you. And your comments, please, Professor McKinnon.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to begin with a concept very central to both Christianity and Judaism, the idea that human beings are created in the image of God, in the Imago Dei. This is something that in my book, Prophetic Encounters, which is, as you mentioned, is just out from Beacon Press, it's really an organizing theme, because what happens again and again in social change movements is that when people encounter one another deeply, they find the divine or they find spiritual reality in that encounter. And throughout U.S. history, when Christians have had these kinds of encounters, they've often used this idea of being created in God's image to talk about the power of that transformation. So, for example, when the white abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison met the young Frederick Douglass, recently escaped from slavery, beginning his own career as a speaker and editor in the struggle against slavery, when Garrison heard Douglass speak, he said, "I've never hated slavery so intensely, because I've never seen so fully the damage it does to the godlike nature of its victims." There was something divine that he could see in Douglass's struggle against slavery. And this is something that I think helps us to see the power of consciousness raising in social change movements. Again and again, not just in the 1960s, but way back into the 1820s, people experience an impression, found new power by gathering together, telling their stories, finding common ground, and claiming new identities. So as American capitalism was just getting started, the workers who saw their fate being diminished by rising capitalism claimed an identity as working men. They built a political party, and for the most part they did it in church, in Universalist churches, in Quaker meeting houses, in Methodist congregations. These were the places where these workers got together and had these consciousness-raising encounters, just as the people in Black Baptist and Methodist congregations in Birmingham and Montgomery and Atlanta in the 1950s and 1960s claimed a sense of somebodyhood through their meeting deeply one another. And this practice of the image of God, if you will, has often been a point of contact between Christians on the left and people who might be described as secular or really as post-Christian. Oftentimes people who were so disgusted with the conservatism of the mainstream churches of their time have turned their back on organized religion, but have continued this spiritual practice of finding the divine in one another. This is what happened to Frederick Douglass. By the end of his career, he said, "If I've ever gotten any glimpses of God in my life, it's been in the faces of the men and women, the whites and blacks, who joined me in this struggle against slavery." And that's something that I find a lot of hope in, that there are spiritual experiences, just as Bob was saying, talking about religion and science, there are spiritual experiences that can really break down that divide between the so-called religious and the so-called secular. And the last thing I'd say is that in the United States, it's really interesting that even the person of Jesus, who you would think would be wholly owned by the Christian community. Even the person of Jesus has been a bridge between Christians and other radical activists, because even if one doesn't accept him theologically as the Messiah, as the Son of God, people have been able to claim him as a radical. So activists in the industrial workers of the world, very bitter against organized religion, would speak about Comrade Jesus and remind the Christians in the churches that Jesus was a bit of a rabble-rouser and identified very deeply with the struggles of the poor in his day.
Then let us do a follow-up to that, if you would, please. You and Michael, I have a separate question on Buddhism for Professor Thurman. What can we find in the Judaic and Christian traditions that lend support to this causative view of our interrelatedness?
Gary, I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Okay, the idea that our ultimate happiness depends upon the happiness of others, and a Christian and a Jew's responsibility to relieve the suffering that Rabbi Lerner just spoke about. In Judaism, I'm thinking of the early rabbinic teachings of Tikkun Olam, or repairing the world, and in Christianity, there are the Beatitudes of Jesus that lay out a series of golden rules to follow that is dedicated to relieving suffering and uplifting those in need. Michael, I'd like both of you to and Dan to talk about this. Speak about the deeper spiritual significance of these teachings or any others you feel are relevant to supporting a view of spiritual activism.
Do you want to go first, Dan, or should I?
You go ahead, Michael.
Well, you know, as I've said, Tikkun, the word Tikkun is the name of our magazine. The healing, repair, transformation of the world is what it stands for. It's the Hebrew word for that healing, transformation, and repair. So from that has come a guidance to us about what our commitment has to be. And it's not a commitment simply to celebrate what is, but also to transform those aspects of what is that need to be transformed, and to change our attitude towards other human beings and towards the world. So the attitude that we have is that we learn from the world we live in is that we are surrounded by other people who are likely to dominate and control us unless we seek to dominate and control them first. And so we have to see other people as potential adversaries and protect ourselves against them. And this is the dominant worldview taught by the capitalist ethos. And the tikkun ethos, the ethos of that I believe is central to the teachings of our great Jewish teachers, including Jesus, who I see as one of our great Jewish teachers, is a different attitude. It's an attitude of love and caring and kindness and generosity, of social justice and peace, and a responsibility to act in the world in that way. Now, we have to go from that general to some specifics about how do you actually make a world that way. And that's why the Network of Spiritual Progressives has proposed a global Marshall Plan to dedicate 1-2% of the gross domestic product of the United States each year for the next 20 to once and for all end global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care. And that has been introduced into Congress by Congressman Keith Ellison, a Muslim, and I think as a Muslim, since I had developed that as a rabbi, it was good to have a Muslim introduce it, and we have many Christians in the Congress who are also behind this global Marshall Plan. This is an alternative to war. This is, instead of thinking that you're going to get homeland security through dominating the other, the way that we can really get it is through generosity and caring. So on our website, we have what we call the Spiritual Covenant with America. And that Spiritual Covenant takes area after area and shows how it would be different to frame those issues in a spiritual discourse. And we're critical not only of the right, but we're also critical of much of the secular left, because it avoids the frames its programs in technocratic discourse rather than in a discourse that emphasizes the kinds of values that actually go across left and right divisions in this society, values about love and caring and kindness and generosity that I think could motivate many people to a progressive viewpoint. And so a step in this direction is that spiritual covenant with America that we've been proposing. And I'm hoping that other spiritual progressives, it's meant to be interfaith, but it's also welcoming, our network of spiritual progressives is also welcoming to atheists and agnostics who have a spiritual consciousness. And by a spiritual consciousness, I mean what I said before about a new bottom line. That is, that they want to replace the definition of productivity and efficiency and rationality with from one based on money and power to one based at least as much on love, on caring, on kindness, on generosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful.
Michael, would you address that, please?
I think that was Michael.
I'm sorry.
This is Dan. And I'll pick up. And I would say, you know, that the Jewish and Christian answers to these questions are very similar, because I think in lifting up the obligation to care for the whole of society and the whole of the world, Christians have always drawn on our Jewish roots. And I'll give one, you know, really central example. According to the Gospel of Luke, Jesus' first sermon in his hometown of Nazareth began with him reading from the prophet Isaiah and taking on himself the words of Isaiah, that the Spirit of the Lord is on me because God has appointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, to proclaim freedom from the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free and proclaim the year of God's favor. And Jesus read these prophetic words and said, this scripture is fulfilled in this moment, identifying his own liberating work with the liberating vision of Isaiah. And one of the things that's happened again and again in Christian movements for social change is that individual Christians have read this same passage and said, and it's happening here and now as well. This is also the year of God's favor. This is also the moment in which we are about the work of unbinding those who are fettered and setting the oppressed free. William Lloyd Garrison made this claim by calling his magazine The Liberator, and many others have done this sort of thing. And so there's this kind of mirroring through the past, that when Garrison identifies with this passage, he's identifying with Jesus and with Isaiah. And if I bring this up today, I'm connecting my own work for social change with the work of Garrison, with the work of Jesus, with the work of Isaiah. And so you have an example of what Christians call the communion of saints, that in working to set the captives free, we're never alone. And we're never isolated just in this one moment where it's happening. We're connected across time to brothers and sisters who have done this work in many, many other times and places. And I think this sense of the importance of being connected to a community that's not limited to any one time or any one place is the reason that I've chosen to focus so much of my own work on history, on telling those stories from the past, as I do in Prophetic Encounters.
Professor,
one of the things, can I just add something in here?
Sure, go ahead.
One of the problems that I think we, all three of our traditions, and in fact all the religious traditions and non-religious traditions face, is that even when we find the values in our tradition, so many of our people, people in our communities, nod their heads and say, yes, statistic. You're really right about all that, but then don't act in the world. And so one of the most difficult things that people have to overcome, and that I've seen overcome in my own work in the not my work particularly, but my involvement with Occupy Oakland, Occupy San Francisco, and Occupy UC Berkeley, is that a critical transformation of consciousness is the transformation in which people begin to see themselves as actors in the world rather than watchers, passively watching. They may sit in front of their television and shake their head at the news and say and think that what's being said is terrible, but they don't see themselves as being the ones who can act. And so one of the things I think all of our religious and spiritual traditions need to work on is how to move people from intellectual agreement and emotional agreement to activism.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that add-on. Professor Thurman, my last question for you. One of the most fundamental and essential Buddhist principles found throughout the Buddhist tradition, and also shown in Sanskrit, is pratitarya samutapada. I'm not pronouncing it exactly correct, but it means co-independent origination.
Oh, yeah. Pratitarya samutapada, yes.
And it's usually, which is the basis for understanding cause and effect, including events and outcomes. And as I understand it, it is for this reason that Buddhism allows us to take a look and say, you cannot separate your personal happiness and well-being and even wealth from the happiness and well-being of everyone else. And now when we speak of engaged Buddhism or green Buddhism or spiritually oriented Buddhist activism, it is this interconnection we all have to each other that serves as the basis for activism and protest for right wrong. So please go into further depth on the cause-effect relationship as understood in Buddhism, and then relate this to your understanding of the impasse we are in today in this nation with a growing police surveillance state that you briefly touched upon, a government fundamentally controlled and dominated by banks and private corporate interests.
Right. Everybody, they're so frightened. These poor people who have so much and feel so deprived, they have to be like guarded day and night. Well, you know, the thing, I loved what Professor McKinnon was saying about how Jesus said that he was going to do this with the poor and liberate the bound and all this, and that the moment it was going to happen is now. I love that. It reminded me of in the Vimalakirti Sutra, a Mahayana Buddhist sutra based on this vision of the causality of interconnectedness and relativity, really, was really the discovery of relativity in ancient time. And there's no non-relational thing that matters, in other words, is the idea. And in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's a thing where the Buddha is asked by some young bodhisattvas, meaning people seeking enlightenment and seeking to benefit the world, the essential role model for the Mahayana Buddhists, universal vehicle Buddhists. And they said, well, we can understand about ourselves traveling toward enlightenment through an evolutionary process and an educational process, but how do we purify the world and how do we beautify the world, they said. That's really hard for us. How do we create the Buddha land, as they call it, you know, the Buddha field or the Buddha land? And the Buddha gives a long spiel about how the Buddha land, you know, the real world of seen by the enlightened person, or that in fact therefore is more real than the one seen by the ignorant person, is a world built of generosity. It's built of justice and morality. It's built of patience and tolerance. It's built of creativity and enterprise and zeal. It's built of concentration, and it's built of deep wisdom and penetrating insight into the nature of causality and why things are what they are. And he goes on and on with that. And then one of the followers thinks in the assembly in the first chapter of this Vimalakirti Sutra. The first work I ever published was a translation of it, actually, Holy Teaching of Vimalakirti. And one of them thinks, well, if that's the case, what happened to this Buddha? Why is he such a gold bricker? This world looks so awful. How could he have created a Buddha land and become a Buddha? Because the Buddha's statement was, you can only be a Buddha when you've turned the land into a Buddha land, you know. So then the Buddha says, well, you know, Sariputra, you know, you don't see it as a perfect land as I do. And he sort of teases him a little bit. And then the Buddha puts his foot on the ground, plants his toe on the ground in a certain way. And suddenly everyone in a vast assembly sees the world as perfect right now. Like what Jesus type of thing Jesus would say, where he would say the kingdom of God is here and now. You know, it's within you and it's here and now in the world too. And everybody goes, wow, you know, I never realized that. And, you know, it really is perfect, and it's really fabulous. I'm in the perfect place where I should be, you know, this kind of thing. And then the Buddha picks his foot up, and then it looks full of faults again, the world, and full of difficulties and full of impossibilities. So the reason I bring it up is that I think one of the key things that spirituality can bring about at this time is try to overcome what Thoreau called, even a century and a half or more ago, you know, the mass of men today leading lives of quiet desperation. I think one reason that people are not occupying the good area, the free area of life all the time, you know, not just now that things have become so bad, so mismanaged by the elite, so to speak, but all the time, is that they think it's impossible to do so. You know, there's too much this image that, you know, oh, great, Jesus said this and Buddha said that and Rabbi Hillel and others said, and Moses and everybody and Isaiah said the other, but look what's really going on. It's really horrible and mess and it's hopeless and there's nothing we can do about it. And so this sense of impotence and sense of inability to change things and that the world is fundamentally flawed is actually also often understood to be what Buddha is saying, that the world just is no good, period. But that is only one level of his thing to get people moving. And the real vision of the Buddha is that the world is perfect. There's no image of God idea, but there is Buddha nature idea. Everyone, all beings, not only human beings, but every animal is going to be a Buddha in their own evolutionary time, and therefore they all have Buddha nature, and therefore which is sort of like the soul, you know, the soul that has to evolve toward realizing itself, you know, and therefore every life is infinitely precious, and one should never destroy it, and so on and so on. Although one cannot really destroy it because everyone is always reborn again and again, infinitely is their view. So, but the vision of what McKinnon said, because, and what Jesus says, that actually if people will stand up and as the rabbi said, and they will act on what they see could be the case, and they just stand for it, then it will happen, because it is here. So it's not like you're creating some unrealistic thing that no one could have, that has never existed, which is the way that we're brainwashed in the wrong teaching of history, that history is a matter of Caesar killing everybody, all the Caesars one after another, having this violent thing and that violent thing, but rather that it is the unfolding of human consciousness and sensitivity and compassion, like today. Finally, the women are coming slowly, picking their heads out of their shells and their sacks where they've been badgered into, and wherever they rise and take their own responsibility and are respected and have their own power, things do go all the way much, much better. And wherever they're not, that's where the real pockets of violence and despair are, where the women are oppressed. So we're seeing these things happening now, and that's because that is reality. And, you know, we're going to succeed, occupy Wall Street, occupy everywhere, occupy the White House. I think Obama's trying to occupy it. But the poor guy is just, you know, it's just so difficult because things have gotten to be like they are. But I think we're going to see a lot of big change. You know, the Mayan people have this thing about a planetary alignment next year, which we're moving toward, and they are very upset that the Western people are going around with this silly thing about how it's the end of the world. And they say it's the end of this terrible materialism time because people are going to wake up their consciousness to reality, to the beauty of it, the wonder of it, whether it's they think of it as made by God or whether they think of it as an interdependent realm of God and man and animals as well, whichever way it is, that this is going to happen now because it has to, because there's no alternative. There's no more pretense that we're sort of going to do it tomorrow. We have to, you know, I really, you know, for example, Jesus says, love your enemy, you know. He says he doesn't care if you love your relatives, that's easy, but he likes to see you love your enemy, he says, right, in the Beatitudes, Professor McKinnon, I believe
Professor
I'm correct
Thurman.
Here, Matthew.
Yes.
Everyone thinks, oh, that's so sweet, but of course that's impossible, we're going to bomb our enemy, right, that's reality, otherwise he'll bomb us. But actually, it's a very practical statement of Jesus, because, and Buddha said the same
Professor
thing.
Professor Thurman, I'm sorry, but we're up to the end of our hour with less than 30 seconds to go. It has gone by very quickly. The Progressive Commentary Hour, our focus on this program was the historical legacy of religion in social protest and the value of spiritual values in constructive protest to advance the transformative state of our political system today and our social activism system. Thank you very much, Rabbi Michael Lerner.
I totally agree with all.
And thank you, Professor Dan McCannon and Professor Robert Thurman. Much praise to all of you for an outstanding input. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.